Okay, I think thank you for the quick introduction. Thank you for being up in the middle of the night, some of you. So let me quickly introduce our speaker today. It is Baruch Schwartz, and Baruch is a researcher on argumentation, one of the most prominent, I would say. But he started with some quite different topics, I would say. So he received his education starting earlier, but one important point was the École Normale Supérieure in Paris, a very famous place in France, in the section of mathematics. He was also at the University of Paris-Orsay and was working on algebraic topology and made his maîtrise in mathematics. So his Master of Science was from mathematics. Also, he received a diplôme d'études approfondies of the same university, Paris-Orsay. And he made his PhD in science teaching at the Weizmann Institute of Science then in the late 80s. He went to the Learning Research and Development Center, LRDC, at the University of Pittsburgh at the beginning of the 90s for his postdoctoral fellowship. He was a lecturer at the School of Education at Hebrew University, well, became senior lecturer there, associate professor, and then also quite some years ago already, a full professor and head of unit of several well, departments, or let's say groups. He is also an advisor of the science teaching department at the Weizmann Institute, and also an advisor at the Mendel Foundation, or he was that. He received a number of awards. Beyond them are the Golda Meir Award and the K Award for Innovations in Science. He is member of several editorial boards of journals that many of you know quite well already: the International Journal of Computer Supported Collaborative Learning, Journal of Thinking Skills and Creativity, and the Journal of the Learning Sciences. He's reviewing for a lot of other journals. He received several large grants that I mentioned these because they were also quite influential in several parts of the world, especially also in Europe, because that were included were funding from the European Union on very big projects on argumentation, where he was a key figure and a coordinator actually in some of these projects, including Argonaut, for example. So I think maybe Baruch, you can speak a little bit more about your interest, but I think your main interest is on argumentation, and you will talk about your main interest for the next time. Let me say one more thing. Under the extra tab, you find two files here. So the extra tab is in the lower part of the screen. An extra tab you find under Manage Files or Download Files. You find two files. One are the slides for today in PowerPoint, and one is the reference list that Baruch sent us. So if you download this, and maybe Baruch, if you can say a little bit and give people also a bit of time to download these files and open it on their screens locally, and then the floor would be yours.
Okay, I think that until people download the files, I think that first of all, I want to say that I'm very happy to be with young researchers to discuss ideas that I like to study. I think that it is one of the things which is the most exciting to share with young researchers what you love, what you are searching alone with your, of course, with your team, but this is quite isolated generally. So I like very much this kind of setting. Especially for argumentation, because as you will see, argumentation is a very, very interdisciplinary topic, and it is very, very important to collaborate with a lot of people, because this domain is extremely complex. So is it okay now to begin my little talk? I propose to people to have the slides that I sent this morning. I will try to follow the slides. I will not see, there are many, many slides. I will not see all of them in my talk, and we will have time for questions in the middle. But I think that it is good to have these files in order to understand and to follow the complex ideas that I will try to expand. Is it okay?
Well, I think as no one complained, I think all of the students have the slides, and yes, we are looking forward to your talk.
Okay, I'm speaking about augmentation and learning, and the first thing that we have to know is that augmentation is and learning, these two terms are two terms which are highly ambiguous. Perhaps we can say that all the things which are very, very big, important, are ambiguous, like love or like ideas, and many things which are very big and very important are ambiguous. So this is the case of augmentation and learning. We will see by now what are the senses of augmentation, but first of all I would like to ask you, perhaps one or two of you, what are the senses that can be given to learning in educational context? What do you think? Don't be shameful. You know, I think that it is important to try to discuss that. Well, okay. I will try to begin the discussion. I would say that learning, in the learning sciences, there are many, many senses, but in fact we can give two very different senses which are very important. Both of them are very important in the learning sciences. The first is a kind of change of behavior which is observable across activities and which is generally checked at the individual point of view. So people would say that I would like to see what are the cognitive gains, the learning gains of the individual in pre-test and post-test. This is one of the most frequent senses of learning. The second one is a sense which is emergent. Learning is a phenomenon which happens, a change which happens in the interaction with many people, and these people interact with each other, and you will see an emerging behavior, an emerging idea which was not detected before, which happens during an interaction. And these two senses are two senses which are very important when we are dealing about argumentation. Now, I want to go now to the first slide, which is about the meanings of the term argumentation. you will see there that you have three main senses which were given by theoreticians in argumentation theory. The first one is the one given by Van Emmeren. Van Emmeren, who speaks about verbal and social activity of reason aimed at increasing or decreasing the acceptability of a controversial standpoint for the listener or reader by putting forward a constellation of propositions intended to justify or refute the standpoint before a rational judge. It is a very, very complicated definition, but in fact, we can try to say that what Van Emmeren has in mind is what he calls a critical discussion. People want to find a way to find the best idea to adopt, and in order to do that, they will discuss, they will challenge each other, they will oppose, they will try to refute, they will also concede, but this is an activity which is social and it is rational. This is the first and very important definition of argumentation, which is a kind of process. It is a process. A second kind of definition is given by Toulmin, and it is in the box. I forgot to put the term, the name of Toulmin into the box, which is a structure. The argument or argumentation is to build a structure. It is not about something social, but it is about elaborating a structure which includes a claim or a conclusion which relies on data of or reasons, and we will try to defend ourselves against alternative claims which try to refute what we want to say. So it is in some way the Toulmin model is asocial. It is not social. It is not like Van Emmeren. And the third model, we have a lot of variants, is a model in which it is the representative of this model is Chaim Perelman in the new Nouvelle Rhetorique in 58, like for Toulmin, who speaks about argumentation as a kind of way to convince people, rhetoric, to convince people that something is true, something is to be accepted. So there's no, the question is not who is right. The three models are right, and we are doing research in a domain in which we have three different kinds of models. We have to add also to this model something which was said by Michael Baker from Lyon, I think. Gregory, I think that Michael was in Lyon for several years, I think, if I'm right. And he said that argumentation is an activity in which the epistemic status of standpoints is at stake. And this says something like that. The people who argue in education at the beginning, they don't know so much what is their standpoint, many times. They don't understand. They are in a fuzzy world. So they will not, when they will defend something that they are not sure about it. And in their interaction, little by little, what they think will be clearer and clearer. This is something which is different from Van Ameren, from Toulmin, and from Perelman. Okay, this is the first, the second thing that I wanted to say. So we have a lot of senses for argumentation. Now, there is something very important which was said by Andreessen and Baker in 2003, which is also a very important distinction in argumentation and learning. The distinction that they did was to distinguish between arguing to learn and learning to argue. Arguing to learn is an activity in which participants aim at or are told to learn about an issue by arguing about it. So argumentation is a tool for learning something. A very powerful tool. Difficult tool to use, but powerful tool. And learning to argue is something which is quite different. It is an activity aimed at the learning of the rules of the argumentative game. That is to say, I want to learn to provide evidence, to refute, to concede, to hear the other, to oppose, to explain, to challenge, and so on. So this is a kind of activity which is well known in informal activities outside the school, but in the school people have to learn that. More, they have to learn that they are expected to do something like that. And this is something very important, very different from arguing to learn. Okay, so we have different senses of learning. We have also different senses of argumentation, and argumentation to learn or learning to argue. So we have a lot of possibilities for research. Collaborating, co-elaborating an argument, trying to convince about own viewpoints, arguing together to confront a difficult issue or to solve a problem. All these things are very important activities in which belong to argumentation and learning, and the dynamics are very different. So we have a very rich field for research, a field which is almost too rich for young researchers. Okay. Now, the question that I asked my at the beginning, when I thought to be a researcher, was whether it's worthy. And I think that it is worthy for three reasons. We are in an educational revolution. We, as citizens of the world, we think about authority in another way. We don't think about authority as somebody knows something and will and this person who knows what the authority transmits what he knows. We have a dialogical vision. We have also, as educators, a collaborative vision. And also we have a vision of critical reasoning. These three reasons are spread over all the educational programs, the progressive educational programs. And argumentation can embody these three visions if it is deployed in the right way. So we have a very rich tool with which it is possible to enact the dialogical, enact the collaborative, and also to enact the critical reasoning. So it is worthwhile. Okay? Now, I want to ask you, I think that, you know, we are about argumentation. If I will only lecture about argumentation, it will really be sad. So I want to ask you a question, and this question I want to ask you to think about this question for 5 minutes, perhaps. I want to ask you about something that I will not speak about because it is too rich, but I want us to think about directions about how it is possible to study learning to argue. Learning to argue, that is to say, the learning of games of argumentation. How do you think that it is possible to search this kind of activity, learning to argue? So I want to ask you, I'll give you the ground, and for 5 minutes I will ask you to try to find ways to think about how it is possible to learn to argue.
Well, I suggest maybe to have a quick round, maybe starting again with Alan Reason, and because this is the sequence that I have on my screen. So if everyone could quickly just comment on the question, even if there is no clear result as of now. Of course, only if you want. I will not force anyone, but I think it would be good to have a kind of a feedback now also on what the results of these discussions were.
So we didn't know if we really get the question. First, it was about studying people to learn to argue, and then the question was, how do people learn to argue? So we argued about how people learned, and the first impulse was something like that there is something implicitly going on, and I had counter arguments against that. So maybe you want to go on with the counter-argument.
Yeah, well, we had this discussion going on that I think we could all agree that there is some implicit learning about argumentation, but then it was my point to say that I don't think that there is, that everything is learned implicitly, and it depends on the personal experience, and that there are still a lot of things that we would have to teach people, like in a, with some formal structures, like formal structure, how you would construct an ideal argument, how that should look like, and what parts are in there, and in which order they should be presented.
And I was arguing about it or against it, that it's pretty much about the knowledge in that field and how you're interested, how your like personal reflection upon the idea is, not so much about domain general competencies and argumentation skills. I think you can always argue better if you just like really like the topic and are really knowledgeable about the topic.
So, and here we are at the moment.
Hi, everybody. I also thought with Gregor we were talking that we must distinguish maybe between learning to argue generally in informal context and for educational context and academic talk, which is pretty specific because you need to explicit all your reasoning which is not always necessary when you arguing in informal context.
And we also kind of thought of different ways that we can intervene or create activities that scaffold learning to argue. And just a general idea that the kind of formal, this is what an argument looks like, is extremely difficult to teach, particularly in oral situations where students are discussing things amongst themselves. And so maybe things like just encouraging discussion of multiple viewpoints is more effective than teaching argumentation structure. And we're wondering what other kinds of ways we could get students to successfully argue.
Well, in comparison to Lyon University, we were explicitly thinking about assessing arguing and to like make an intervention and teach or talk about specific aspects of argumentation to foster the argumentation, and by this also at the end have a tool for assessment, because then you're like focusing on a specific aspect that you can evaluate at the end of a study or your intervention, and we were mostly talking about that.
I think what I was thinking was, and this is possibly connecting both the ideas presented by Lyon and NCLS, is if you sort of present to students a sort of a rubric which tells them, well, okay, once you present your ideas, you need to be able to defend it, and also you need to have some ways to basically support your claims by, you know, evidence, and make sure that, you know, if somebody asks a question, you should be able to defend your answer. So that could be maybe another way to teach students about arguing and supporting what they believe in.
Okay. I would try. I see that I heard very interesting things. I think that there is something which is very important here. The reason why I began by asking this question, which is a bit not popular so much in general, is because most of the research in argumentation is done in isolated efforts. And argumentation is first of all a culture. And this culture has been for many, many hundreds of years, it has been the culture of a kind of education in Roman, Greek, Arab, Jewish education. Argumentation was something which was extremely frequent. And now in the classroom, we don't have this kind of talk. The talk is much more teacher-centered, and this is something which has its reasons. It's not bad, but it has to be balanced. And what I heard by each of you was about how people learn that, and as I heard by the LMU team, it is that there are things which are implicit, which are learned in informal settings, but that we as the teachers have to give something which is more than what they get out of school. And this is something which is very important. And I think that this is a revolution which happens in many domains, in mathematics, in science, in civic education, in history, and so on. More and more people, teachers, try to get students to to participate in argumentative discourse. And this is something which is very important. Now, the question, I wanted us to think about that as a pedagogical question, but there is also the research question, which is, how is it possible for us to see that people develop their argumentative skills? The person who did tremendous work about that was and still is Diana Kuhn from Columbia University. She's a developmental psychologist, and she adopted two kinds of methodologies. The first methodology is a methodology of a pre-post test with a kind of through tools and structures, interviews, she tried to assess argumentative skills. For people in the learning sciences, it seems a bit, how to say that? We don't accept now to measure learning only by measuring the skills before a treatment or after a treatment. But this is something which is important, that Diana Kuhn gave a treatment during 1 year or 2 years, and in her treatment she tried to ask the teacher to encourage students to argue, to participate in discussions, and after the treatment, she tried to see what are the argumentative skills. But she did also other things, which was to try to see through the analysis of consecutive talk practices, to see emerging practices, to see at week 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., to see in the talk that she analyzed whether there are arguments, reasons, counter-argument, and so on. She did things like those. Now, I think that this is something which is very important. I will not speak about that today because it's complicated. But I think that I wanted to refer to that because we have to know that our research about argumentation has to be done in a context in which not only we will give a pretest or a nice software to students to discuss about that. Students who do not have any culture about argumentation, but to have programs to enhance argumentation as a practice. And this is something which is very important. I think that people in the States like Sarah Michaels and Kathy O'Connors with Accountable Talk are doing something which is argumentative, and it is run, I think, in thousands of schools, and I like their work very much. It is a long-term effort and very difficult, but I think that we have to know about that, and we have to know about the methodologies that we use. I propose each of you to read one or two papers by Diana Kuhn about her methodologies to see how in programs, educational programs, it is possible to see the progression and the development of argumentation. So this was about learning to argue. Now, I want to pass now to the study of arguing to learn. And we have here I'm now at slide 7. We have here a basic methodological challenge. It is a challenge, very big challenge, which is the following challenge. Generally what we have is that we have a pretest. We will give a pretest to people in a group individually. After that, we will give some instructions or some script, a kind of invitation to argue in some way. And after that, we will have a dialogue that we deploy. And this dialogue will sometimes will be argumentative, and sometimes it will not. There is no no reason why, or there are reasons, but it is not sure that after giving an invitation to argue, the dialogue that we will have will be an argumentative dialogue. And we will have a post-test. So, if we have a pretest, an invitation to argue, a dialogue which is perhaps not argumentative and a post-test, the question is to know whether we have something which is about arguing to learn. Here the arguing to learn is in the instructions, but many times, as I said, many times students get the instructions, but they do something else. And this is something very important, to know that we have the invitation to argue, the intention of experimenters. We have a setting, the people are together, we tell them, okay, you have to explain to each other, you have to express challenge and so on, but people are doing whatever they want. And here the discrepancy between the intention of the researcher and what deploys is something which is extremely, it is fundamental. It is a problem, and these problems turns research on argumentation to something very complicated. Okay, now I will try to show you some little some studies in order to show you the problems that we have. We will see some examples. The example that I will show you, the first one, will be an example which was for me encouraging. I began in the 2000s, I began to do research on argumentation, and what I did was to say, okay, I know that children have problems about decimal numbers. That is to say, when they see 4.64, they don't know exactly what is 64, and they have conceptual bugs. They think, for example, that 4.221 is bigger than 4.64. Why? Because 221 is bigger than 64. And this is something which is very, very, very solid among students in elementary schools. There are also students who have other conceptual bugs. They will say that 4.3 is bigger than 4.4 because 0.3 says that you have to divide a pie in three parts, and 4.4 the four says that you have to divide the pie in four parts. So three parts is bigger than four parts. And this is something which is very, very robust among elementary students. So I asked to myself, okay, is it possible to give students ways to learn about decimal numbers, not by teaching them that, but by having a setting in which there is a didactic interaction between them, and by the interaction, they will try to find out together and to find the right rules for decimal numbers. So we can see the six card task, which was designed to encourage argumentation. Six cards containing the digits 00584 and a decimal point were presented to the students. The goal was to use all cards to construct the biggest number possible, the smallest number possible, the number closest to one, the number closest to one half, and there were dyads who had a calculator at disposal. In slide 9, I will show you what happened. It is a big research, but I will show you a glimpse of interaction, a protocol between two students, V and C. You can see that he says the numbers after the period go smaller. 4, 5, 8 is smaller than 8, 5, 4, and because of that, my number is smaller. So the student says why he thinks that one number is smaller than another one. And C says, if you take a pie and you divide into 4, 5, 8, each part will be larger than if you divide by 8, 5, 4. So the two students here use two different strategies. We don't have to enter into all the complexities of what is said, but the two students disagree. And when V sees that C disagree with him, he says, I don't know. She says, she takes the calculator, multiplies the number by 10, the number she doesn't know what is this number, and she obtains 4, 5, 8. And she multiplies the number by 10 and obtains 0.854. So, and it continues. So what I wanted to say here is, we don't have to understand what is all the interaction, but what happened is that students who disagreed could explain to each other why they disagreed, used a computer to see and a strategy multiplied by 10 who is right, and they try to explain to each other. What happened was astounding effect. When two wrong students interacted together, they gained more than when a wrong student interacted with a right student. Because when you are wrong, you want to know more, you want to ask more, and you want to listen to the other, because generally many times you are not sure about what you say. So here we saw that many of the students who interacted without any intervention by the teacher moved their conceptual box. But, and this is something very, very important, it was something which is post hoc. the term post hoc says that we see here that the students progressed, and we see that many of the students who progressed were argumentative. But we don't know whether the reason why students were progressed was the argumentation. Perhaps it's something else. Perhaps it is the disagreement. Perhaps it is something else. We don't know. It is post hoc. We see that the people who progressed argued, but we don't know why they progressed. My hypothesis, research hypothesis, was that they progressed because they argued. But in order to prove that, it was something more complicated. Perhaps I will ask Frank to know how we can continue my little lecture before I go to another direction.
Well, I think we have about 30 minutes left, and given the number of your slides, I think maybe we ask the participants for some comments. But I would say go on. It's great to hear you speaking about your own studies and the misconceptions or the bugs that people, young people, have in their minds. But maybe there are questions also from side of the students.
Okay. Hi. So I got a question, because you were explaining it with the example of the two students about the mathematical ideas. And I was wondering if you what you say to someone who says, but that's reciprocal teaching, right? Because for me it was not. That this was not an example for argumentation, because there was one knowledgeable student and one not knowledgeable student. And the one said, it's like that, and the other said, no, it's like that. And then the other said, oh, okay, you're right, but I don't know why. Please explain it to me. So how is it different from just teaching? And yeah, it's more an explanation idea, right, than argumentation. Well, for me it was. So do you differentiate?
Okay, it is a very good question. In fact, the student V is not teaching, because when here in this particular case, he had the right answer. But if you ask, for example, what is the biggest number, 4.85 or 4.254, the student would say 4.254 is bigger, because 254 is bigger than, I don't remember it, whether it's 85. So I gave here one protocol, but there were many protocols in which the answer of the explanation given by the student in general terms was not applicable. And when checking with a computer, the student could see that his or her explanation was not valid. So the two students here are two students who are in general wrong. Okay, so and this is they had only it is because of that I gave four subtasks, because I expected that for the four tasks, for some of the tasks, one of the students with one conceptual bug will show explanations which are not applicable. So which is what I...
Uh, I think if there are currently no other questions, I mean, you have in the slides, I think what would be very important for students to know, especially if they think about doing studies on argumentation, what are some of the methodological issues or problems that you are faced with when you are dealing with the argumentation research. And then what I also like in your slides is the very concrete ideas how to facilitate argumentation with some scaffolding and prompting of arguments. That would be, I think, two emphasis that you could put during the last half an hour, if you agree.
Yeah, willingly. Now, I sent you here in the slide 10 and the following slide 10, there are two studies that Christa Stenham and myself did in order to do a control study of benefits of argumentation. And in this control study, I think that we'll not have the time to see that, but I really I would encourage each of us to read these papers, not because I was one of the authors, but because I think that these are two studies on the same data which show the difficulties which are methodological. For example, the statistical problems, because of course we have problems of dependencies, of the fact that each student is in a group, so how it is possible to see individual gains. We have statistical solutions, and also something that we try to show in cognitive science is how it is possible to recognize the deployment of argumentative talk. And what we showed there, which is something very important, we showed that not all kinds of argumentation are productive in terms of conceptual gains. What we showed is that only dialectical argumentation, which is something which is with a lot of challenges, but not adversarial, is productive. Consensual argumentation, in which everybody will say, oh yeah, you are right, and explain, is not very good, at least when we try to see conceptual change, so something in which the change is very deep. In order to have a deep change, people have to be critical, to attack each other, but in a way which is not only polite but respectful. In that way, when there are disagreements, but the disagreements are handled in a respectful way, it is highly productive. So this is what I would say about that, and I really. It would be very, for me, it's very, very important to, I think, I encourage you to read these things. Also something which is very important in this study, it is that the learning gains that we showed there were about, we tried to see whether we have learning gains which are number of ideas or schemas, and if we try to see in control studies with a control group and experimental group the difference, we saw that if we treat knowledge as something like you see in the market a number, a quantity of ideas, argumentation is not good, not very good. Argumentation is good for changing the schema, for changing the whole thing, and this is very important. So it is good for reorganization of ideas, and this is what we showed in these two studies. Now, according to what Frank asked from me, I think that I will only speak about now, first of all, I will speak about slide 20, about the importance of the norms of a domain. Frank, that you are from very different domains. There are, if I understand well, there are science, people who learn science, people who learn mathematics, and perhaps there are people who learn humanities. And what is important here is that argumentation in different domains have different norms. And for example, the argumentation in science has to be put into integrated into inquiry-based activities. So it is not arguing for arguing about ideas. The argumentation has to be a part of finding ideas, finding hypotheses, checking hypotheses, discussing, arguing about that, and after that, drawing conclusions. In mathematics also, it is something which is very different. Argumentation has to be, is to be close to precede proving, and this is something which happens now more and more with Azzarello, Boero, Inglis and Ramos. We have many people who speak about argumentation and proving, which are two activities that have to be put in one continuum. And in history, there is a big boom of argumentation in history, but it has to be coupled with reading and evaluation of multiple texts. Without reading and evaluating text, evaluation in the sense that we try to see who is the author, what are the motives of the authors, and whether the people who say that what they say have enough evidence to say what they say. If you don't try to evaluate the text, the argumentation is useless. So you have to see argumentation in history in that context. Now I will speak with you about argumentative design, which is in slide 21. What we know is that research has now shown that productive argumentation, in the sense that we try to find argumentation with cognitive gains, learning gains, is very difficult to emerge, very difficult to do that, but that its emergence leads to deep gains, for example, conceptual gains. It is something which is extremely so it is extremely important to do that, but it's also difficult. So because of that, we have to know to design activities in order to encourage argumentation in the interaction. And there are many researchers who try to think about what to do. For example, the arrangement of initial cognitions. And what I mean by arrangement of initial cognition is two things. First of all, to know in advance, to try to know whether people agree or disagree about an issue. And the second thing is to know about the strategies of the students. Now, the issue is very complicated, because I don't say necessarily that for argumentation people have to disagree at the beginning. What can happen, and which is many times extremely productive is that I intentionally put people who agree together and I give them an apparatus, an experiment, a text which contradicts what they both think. So we have a situation of socio-cognitive conflict. This is something which is very, very good. Sometimes the best would be to have a situation of disagreement, but not always. And there are many, I can, if you have questions about that, I can try to give my ideas about that. But this is a kind of decision which is not very easy to take, that we have to take into consideration initial cognitions. The second thing is the provision of proper tools timely, and the problem of timely is extremely important. To give multiple texts, it can be in history, but in science also, even in mathematics. To give timely also hypothesis testing devices, to give feedback to people. But to give that also timely, and when you have that, of course, this feeds the argumentation. When people get these tools and they see many times that there is a social cognitive conflict that they have to overcome. Proper instructions. So here I will not dare to speak about scripts when Professor Fischer is here. He did a great work about that, and I think that I would only say that you know, we know that when we read newspapers, we can be manipulated. Manipulation in information can be something very bad, but in education, giving scripts influences a lot interactions, and I think that we have carefully to think how we give our scripts, because the scripts have a very profound influence on the interaction. It is very, very important. As you know, not to give too much, not to give over scripts, especially to bright students. Bright students can do a lot of things without getting the big brother telling him what to do or telling her what to do. So the question of giving the proper instruction or scripts is a tricky one, but it is very important. And also the structuring of peer argumentation during argumentation. You can find in a chapter by Jerry Anderson and myself about argumentative design, which is one example in which try to list what are the kinds of designs of preparation that we can do in order to encourage the productive interaction. Now I would like, do I have time to show a beautiful paper done by Jonathan Osborne and Christine Chin about supporting argumentation through student question? Do you think that I can do that in 5 minutes? Is it okay for you, Frank?
Yes, okay, 5 minutes, and then maybe we have a final round of questions. I would also have one or two more, and I think 5 minutes are perfect. Baruch, would you like to show that study? I think the 5 minutes are fine with us. If you show the study, and we have then afterwards, we would have another 5 minutes or so to discuss and have questions and so on.
Okay, Now, it is about Sheenan Osborne. Jonathan Osborne worked with Rosalind Lind, Driver about science. He's a leading scientist in science education. It is about a block of ice which is uniformly heated in a closed container. How does the graph of the water look like? So, we have two graphs in 23 and 24. The first one is linear, the second one is curved with a curvature. And the question is to know what is the best graph. And when we ask students about what is the best graph, you will get something very poor. Some asking students to choose one graph, then discuss in small group with no learning. Nothing happens. I think this is this graph, and I think this is the other graph. Nothing more happens. Given the list of additional facts, no learning followed small group argumentation. If I give all sorts of facts, it doesn't help. But if students are encouraged to list questions about the graph, small group argumentation was found productive. So it's not only to give the question a beautiful question and to give them facts to feed what happens, you can see the list of additional facts. It's not only that, but it is to help them ask questions. And we don't have time, we will have time to see what happens, but only when we give these things. And only when after that you have at the end, you can see at page, but you will see further scaffolding of a construction or scientific argumentation according to the tooling model. When you give all these scaffoldings, when you give all this, only when you give all this, okay, thank you very much. Only when you give all this, you can have the ways to evaluate the quality of arguments. I will skip. We have a beautiful interaction between students that I showed here in four slides. All that only to tell you that we can cause students to have beautiful interactions, but we have to sweat a lot. We have to give structures, we have to give facts, we have sometimes to help them ask the right questions, and only after they have asked the right questions and they got scaffolding, they are able to do a real argumentative discussion. I think that it is great. This study is great because it shows two things that I wanted us to understand. The first one, that it is very expensive, a lot of efforts to cause the deployment of rich argumentation about learning tasks. But when we do the right things, we have fantastic results, and after that the students are able to do to use what they did in the argumentation in further activities. I will finish with the hot issues in argumentation and learning that I couldn't speak about. The first one is the role of a teacher in facilitating argumentation for learning, which is tricky because argumentation has to be something free, something in which the authority of a student has to be intact. They have to be autonomous. So the teacher has to be very subtle in his interaction, in his interventions. Be, for example, the devil's advocate. Or be like the others, another participant, and ask questions which, but in a very subtle way. It is not very easy. The second thing which is enormous and that I didn't touch here is the CSCL tool for facilitating augmentation for learning. I was involved in many of these on these initiatives, but I think that it was, I preferred to say basic things about augmentation. The other things I think perhaps will be given by other speakers. I can also give a lot of, many people did interesting things about that. CSCL tools for facilitating moderation of a teacher of augmentation. So here it can be something fantastic. The role of epistemic beliefs in augmentation, that is to say, what I think about the source of the knowledge, how to acquire knowledge, and so on. If people have specific epistemic beliefs, it impinges in argumentation profoundly. And people like Michael Nussbaum has done great research about that. The role of motivation also, which is something very, very important for achieving goals in argumentation for learning, and also gender studies in argumentation for learning. So this is a little list. I think that I said not enough, but I think that it is a beginning for you. I would be happy to hear questions if you have. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Baruch. And now, okay, some time for your question and comments so far. I give, well, a couple of seconds, and then I would also have some questions. Let me start with one question. Maybe it's one question to the content of your talk again. Well, reading the paper that we distributed beforehand, Argumentation and Learning, I wondered, and also you pointed a little bit to that today, there is a kind of deficit perspective in some research on argumentation, and I would say also some of the participants in this webinar have done research from that perspective that says, well, we have participants from school or from universities, and they have big and severe problems in doing argumentation. And there's another perspective saying, well, it's really astonishing what even very young children have achieved already, or what university students would be able to do if we put them into the right context. And I wanted to ask you, Baruch, because I know you have a specific perspective on that, maybe to tell what your perspective on this is. So is it better to start your research from a deficit perspective, so they have problems, I will help them, or is it better to start from, well, there is a great potential, there are great skills already, but they need to be supported in a way to be transferred to that new context? And then there is another question by LMU, Reason, but maybe, well, we can just, I'll just stop.
Okay, well, you know, I think that here it comes back to the question about learning to argue. There are people who are like Kuhn, people like Stein and Miller in the 90s, who did great developmental studies in which they showed that young children at the age of five or six are able to refute arguments when they engage in discussions with a father, with a pause, about things which are which they like, things which are very important for them. And so it shows here that there is something general that we have, and in my view, this thing about argumentation somehow is strangled by the school. In the school, we don't dare to argue because there is an authority, and because also many times we don't know what exactly is our aim except for pleasing the teacher. But there is also something else. The child who is arguing with his father knows a lot about, you know, coming very late at home and what to say and all the strategies and all the ways to conceal things. In argumentation in science, we have to know a lot, evidence and ideas and so on. So there are two things, I think. The first one is that we are not knowledgeable about science, history, mathematics. We don't have enough ideas. And the second thing is the disposition that we have to school learning, to school talk. And I think that the first thing to do is, first of all, to educate students and to help students to understand that they are expected to talk, to argue, to challenge, even if their ideas are shaky, and not to accept because I have spectacle glasses and because I'm a little bald. Really, we have children and adolescents have to understand that the rules of the game here are rules of expressing my doubts, daring to oppose, and in order to that, this is a culture. The second thing is to get a lot of knowledge about, and also to ask very interesting questions. Questions in mathematics or in science many times are not extremely interesting, but if we have interesting questions, people have the motivation to argue.
Okay, I'm just wondering, like, if we have two students, one with like very high ability and the other one has a low ability, how can we really get them to argue against each other when, like, the person with the low ability doesn't have the basic knowledge to do that?
Okay, sorry, maybe you answer the two questions at the same time. I was wondering, you said argumentation is a culture, but you showed some diagrams like tool means, and there's a very specific conventions for academic and scientific talk. But how can we actually, in educational settings, deal with different cultures that the students may have, and how could they maybe, can we take it into account to bring them to a argumentative culture, which would be conciliated with each different culture?
Okay, so I will answer the two questions. The first one, which is about two students, one is knowledgeable and the second one is not, so there is a kind of asymmetry. So I think that we don't have to be orthodox about argumentation. There are different kinds of interactions, and the interaction in which one knowledgeable try to explain to the other why he is right and tries to convince the other that he is right by giving examples by repeating his or her explanations is something very good and very acceptable. Because of that, we have to think about different kinds of dialogues, and it's not only about symmetry. Symmetry is good sometimes, but many times there is no symmetry, and we have to see other kinds of argumentation because of that, or other kinds of talk, which have to be blended in the same entity. And I think that heterogeneous groups in which somebody knows a bit more than the others and tries to explain is something extremely important, but even here there have to be talk rules of respect, of explicitness, of ethical, which is about the fact that I will try to be very clear about what I say, not to be scornful because I know more. And I think that these two kinds of practices have to be fostered equally. So it is very, very important, not only argumentation with symmetric interactions. Now, for the question about cultural differences. You know, I am here in Israel, I'm here in Jerusalem, on the Mount Scopus, and I can show you in front of me an Arab village, which is here, 50 meters from me. And we are in a culture, it's not only that we have political contentious, but also we have a culture of a lot of argumentation, a lot. And I know that, for example, I was in Neuchâtel for half a year, and I gave a course there. I saw people who had totally different cultural rules of talk and of argumentation. These differences exist, they are part of our cultural assets. In Germany, in France, in Arab countries, in my country, there are very different cultural differences. For example, the way people try to oppose to the other. The way people oppose to the other in Israel would be felt as very, very aggressive in another country, and here it is not aggressive. But at the same time, I think that in all the countries we have to give back to respectful argumentation the place that it had in education in many countries before there was the industrial revolution in which people had to learn a lot of things very, very quickly and without discussing. We have to disagree and to handle the disagreement very well. It is a part of our democracies. It is a part of being a citizen in our countries. So I think that this is something beyond all the cultural problems. This is something that we have as educators to foster in all the countries.
Thanks for your answer. I would have another question, if it's okay. It's about something that is mentioned in the basic reading for the webinar today. There's actually two points. There are studies mentioned let's say that roughly around like the mid-20s, the people like on a population level have the highest argumentation skills, and after that actually argumentation skills decrease when people get older. And I would like to ask you what you think why that is and what we could do against this. Also, you just mentioned that just from this perspective that argumentative skills are so important for democracy. I feel it's not good that argumentative skills decrease when people get older.
Well, I think that this is something in long-term learning of people. This is something that people learn to conform. They learn to conform to their job, to their family, and to accept things for the good and for the less good. And this is a situation that people in the past had to be extremely conform to what is expected from them. But I think that now there is a new trend in the society, in the sense that people change their jobs, they change also their careers many times, and I feel that although, as you said, there is a decline in the argumentative skills because of the fact that people get accustomed, you know, they have to do the same thing and not to renew the knowledge and the challenges, the society demands from people to change. And I think that in that context, I think that the situation will begin to be different. I feel also that for people, I'm not sure, but I think that Diana Kuhn showed that there was no decline among people who learned in universities. Not because we are better, we are the upper class, it's not that, but it is because we learned to deal with texts, with different perspectives, and we learned a lot of practices which are extremely important. How to read, I'm sure that you and I know how to read newspapers and to say, okay, this article is bullshit, I beg your pardon, because how can you know that, and how this is not based on facts, it is only interpretation. So I think that new programs that that foster argumentation, how to read, how to write, how to discuss, can change this trend. This being said, I would say that high-level argumentation demands a very high cognitive load, and I think that this we know, is difficult to handle for people who are getting older. So there is here something that we can't struggle against.
Okay, well, I think this session is coming to an end. I would like to thank Baruch and all the participants very much, Baruch, for his excellent introduction into argumentation. I think we learned, or I learned at least, that it is complicated. So argumentation is not a simple structure, a rhetorical structure. It is much more. But I think also Baruch, you still encouraged us to do research and to research in a differentiated way on this complicated topic. I think what I found also especially encouraging is that you put it into a broader context, like culture, lifelong development, and so on. And if I would summarize what you said in the end is, well, even if you get older, don't stop to disagree. And I would like to thank you very, very much for this excellent talk and introduction. And again, thanks everyone who participated for your contributions and for your reflections on this.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be with young researchers. It will be a pleasure for me to answer questions and to be in contact with PhD students. Thank you very much.